Before we get to today's show, I want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Veracross. With a single record database and the strongest API in the industry, Veracross is the leading SIS provider for private and independent schools, and it's now available in Australia. Support us by supporting them, so visit veracross.com/edleaders to learn more. Now let's get to today's show. Welcome to Ed Leaders, the podcast covering all the interesting ideas about leadership, strategy, culture, and the business of K-12 education, where we believe that with better leaders, we make better schools. I'm your host, Luke Kelly, and joining me each week in the chair is my co-host and colleague, Matthew Irving. Before we get started, if you haven't already, you should sign up to the weekly email sent out by the team at Ed Leaders. Matt, here we go. He's got a giggle on his face. He knows what's coming. What should someone expect in the email?
Well, I'm pleased you asked, Luke. I really am pleased that you asked. Look, I think what's awesome about it is that it takes you out of the edu space and it takes you into business, takes you into tech, takes you into the workplace. There's lots of transfer in terms of some of the things that are in the newsletter, and we can guarantee there's always going to be a takeaway for you. How's that, Luke?
Yeah, it's pretty good. I like the use of the word transfer there, Matt. It's very educational. Well played. You can sign up to the newsletter at edleaders.com.au. Now, on to today's guest, Michael Christensen. Michael is a director at M3 Architecture, a well-known firm in Brisbane that commenced operations in 1997. And today we are talking buildings and design. Matt is excited. This is one of his pet areas of interest. He's been working on a building for the last 18 years that he hasn't got built yet. But let's get to today's show. Let's get to it. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Luke. Thanks, Matt.
Now, we'd love to start the podcast by talking about a little bit about your professional journey and how you've got to be where you are today.
Sure. Well, I guess my journey in M3 architecture, you know, it's a practice that I set up with a partner virtually straight out of university. And you're right, our focus is education work, and that was a conscious decision, I suppose. We had, you know, my partners, we went through university when it was a part-time course, so we were working in other practices all the way through. And there wasn't the sort of sense of fulfillment on a lot of the projects that we were working on. And, you know, we sort of stepped back, and when we decided to set up our own practice, looking at that, we sort of identified that the thing for us was that the projects that we were working on were for clients that weren't really interested in their building. It was about something else. And, you know, if it was a shopping center or turning a dollar, it was just a little bit of a different focus. So we sort of sat down and worked out the different sectors and wanted to work for clients that were sort of wanting to build something that was, you know, a long-term thing, an investment, something that actually meant something to them, not to somebody else or to a super fund's bottom line. Just because of because of that layer of quality and care and all those other factors then become an important part of the building process. So that sort of steered us to owners of buildings and long-term owners, and the education market is a sort of a perfect example of that. You know, we targeted university work when we first went out, and, you know, as we've sort of evolved, we've sort of moved into sort of secondary education as a client type. So that's sort of probably 90% of our work now is education, and it was from that initial focus.
So there's a real sense that, you know, between yourself and your other directors, that you've been really attracted to purpose-driven organisations rather than profit-driven organisations. That'd be a fair...
I think that's fair. I mean, it's not to say that we don't do, you know, or we won't do work for the right, you know, commercial or profit-generated entity. It's if they're trying to do the right thing. So, yes, a purpose-driven is a characteristic of our work, and that's what we enjoy sort of nutting through with a client to find, you know, that idea or the concept that actually relates to what that entity is trying to do or that individual is trying to do.
We had an architect come through one of our buildings just recently, and they talked about kind of some of the features that we use. And I think to your point, as an owner of a building, if you want to say that, that's going to have a building for 30, 40, 50 years, like some of the products that have been chosen in that building, this architect was saying, in a commercial sense, you just wouldn't see anymore because you know, of cost cutting or of, you know, people making kind of choices based on, you know, quickness of being able to get materials. Is that kind of also what you're getting at there, that kind of deliberate choice making when it comes to design and what's being used?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the selection of a material is a classic example, yes, and that's an easy example to relate to. But it's not just about picking the most expensive thing; it's about picking the right thing, and that's across, you know, all decisions from, you know, long-term master planning. What philosophy of the school, and what are you trying to reflect in the buildings that you're building on your campus? What's it trying to say to your community, to your, you know, the students that you're educating? What message are you trying to get across? So all of those sort of just sort of deeper level thoughts, I guess, that you know, when you're working on a shopping center and it's about area and cost and, you know, the short term decision because we're about to sell it, you know, as soon as it's finished. It is a different philosophy, and I think it just brings another layer to the conversation. There's plenty of education projects that don't go into that, but it's more likely that the owners of those sorts of buildings are invested and want to do things properly.
And Michael, as you've progressed from, you know, being that student and working in other firms to starting your own practice, just really curious as to sort of other role models that you've had along the way that have helped sort of shape, you know, the understanding and the philosophy that you've sort of developed there at M3 Architecture.
Yeah, sometimes those role models are the exact opposite. I don't want to do it like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's so not great to dwell on the negative, but it depends on who you're exposed to and how that works. One of my partners worked, you know, he wasn't a director or a leader in the office. He was just an individual. And we sort of talked about his philosophy a lot at the time. And that individual has influenced a lot of, you know, what we believe in and how we've developed and things that we sort of identify and find important. But, you know, then the flip side of that is you're in practice and you're looking at things and just say, well, look, I don't really feel comfortable, you know, or that approach. I kind of see why you've done it, but it's not something that my own ethic or what I believe in. So you're sort of, you know, you're learning, not as it's a negative role model, I guess, in that instance, but it's sort of just trying to work out, you know, what in the industry matches your own belief system.
Yeah.
It's hard for architecture because these projects just go for so many years and it takes a long time to sort of see the results of your work. So it is, you know, that is a sort of a challenge working through, and you can get sort of caught up in that snowball. So it is hard to sort of step off and think about what you're doing when you're caught up in the moment of delivering a project.
When you talk there about you know, that length of process when you kind of are going through a project, you know, is there steps along the way of the journey that bring you fulfillment, or is it ultimately when you see the finished product that's the fulfillment that comes with being an architect?
Yeah, I think I mean that's definitely the obvious result, right? You know, most architects enjoy being in their profession to deliver built work. That's what we're on about. You know, I work with a boss that where that wasn't the issue, because it, you know, that the hardest way to make money out of it is the longer that the project goes. And if you can get out early, that's the most profitable. But for most of us, I think it is about that end result. But I think when you're working with an engaged client, you know, who really cares about the outcome as well, there's so many little milestones along the way and aha moments that that bring the joy. And you know, for us, most of the projects that we work on are typically, you know, you're involved in it for 2, 3, 4 years, and that's almost all you're doing in that time period. So if you've got to wait 4 years for that sense of joy, that's a tough ask. So, you know, working in this sector, you know, with sort of inspiring people or very creative people, and you know, in the tertiary education sector as well, with researchers and seeing what they're doing, those little jet steps along the way are the great things about what we do in education. You know, you learn some amazing things from the clients you work for.
So I'd love to talk a little bit about the design process. You know, that first meeting with the client, you sat them down for the first time. What are you trying to glean from those first few interactions?
Yeah, and it's a really hard process, Matt, because most, especially in the secondary and primary sectors, most clients aren't professional building clients. You know, they're typically very good at their job, and their job is typically not delivering buildings. So a lot of the first few meetings end up being an educational process where we're trying to bring somebody along the journey and explain, you know, what is sketch design, what is, you know, all these sort of pragmatic things. But that's, I'm sure that's not what your question is. Just in terms of those first things that we're really after. So apart from, you know, setting the client up for success in terms of how they manage their project and allocate their time and the things they need to think about, that's sort of what we've got to impart. But what we're trying to get back out of our clients is it's probably just trying to get to a deep understanding of what they're on about, because every sort of education institution, and even when you're working in tertiary education, you know, there's such big organisations, even the various strands and schools and research centres, they're all different and they've all got their own little quirks and focuses and what they're trying to do. And so for us, it's trying to tease that out, just to try and understand what makes them tick and what's their point of difference, you know, their philosophy, what are they trying to do themselves, so that we can then pick up on that message and see, you know, sift through all of that and try and find something that, you know, that we can adapt into the design process and adopt and turn it back into a project that actually reflects that organization's, you know, attitude or ideals or what they're trying to say about themselves.
And are there any, you know, in that discovery phase, are there any sort of tools or sort of key questions that you've come to use that you know that will elicit the right kind of response early on?
Not really. Well, I think everybody's different, and every client group is different. One of the things for us is being able to set that initial client group up so that you're dealing with the people that have that responsibility at the school, you know, if it is a school or the education facility. So it's, for us, it's more about getting to the core or to the key leadership drivers. And it's not always the principal or whatnot. You know, it depends on the school, and to try and set up a system that you can do that and you can have that open dialogue without having too many blockages in the way. You know, that we have the modern building industry. It's complex. There's a lot of risk. You know, often there are layers that are set up between, you know, your client and the design team, and they're set up for what might be valid reasons in terms of management processes, but they are really, we've got to work out how to navigate that to get through. So that the key is actually getting to figure out who is actually the person that knows or is driving the culture or the organization of the school, and working out who else, you know, who are the managers and who don't really know what they're on about and, you know, what's important to different people. So it's who's who in the zoo, and then trying to work out how to get that relationship and communication going between the right people.
And for an aspiring kind of, I guess, education leader who, you know, might be a middle leader who's just come out of the classroom, can you kind of, and who's never been involved in a building project, can you kind of talk about the types of people that you normally see at the table when these types of discussions are happening, both from, I guess, a school's point of view, but I guess the other consultants that can sometimes be in the room in some of the earlier design process conversations?
Yeah, it is tricky, but it's like getting advice from any profession, I suppose. The key is finding the consultant that you can relate to, and that you can have, you know, frank conversations with. You can you know, you, and you're comfortable to work together, because it is, it's a very involved process, and it does, it does take a lot of time. And you know, most educational institutions are sort of, you know, they're pretty efficient, and they run on the smell of an oily rag, quite a few of them, and you've just got to be really careful with how you allocate your resources. So one, you know, so that first step of appointing somebody and finding somebody to work with is a big step. I mean, it's like, you know, appointing new senior staff member or any of those sort of key steps. But then once you've got, once you're on board, you need to set up a system that you can, you know, you trust them to do their job rather than to stifle their job. And so it is, it is about that process. But in terms of a new person, it's difficult, but you, it you can't underestimate the amount of time it takes. And I think most of the successful relationships with education institutions, and when we've done projects, the schools have managed to set up a system where that person, they're not fully relieved of their day job, but they're assisted in a way that they can then also commit to, you know, doing or working on the building project, because it is a very involved thing. And it's, you know, if your day job, if the quantity of what you have to do doesn't change, then this is the thing that gets distracted or neglected, and it's a tricky thing. So whether that's at the principal level or whether that's at a deputy kind of level, you know, horses for courses. You know, some principals are really good at articulating their culture and just defining what they need, and others, that's not their thing. And you know, they've got a deputy that is the right person, and once you work that out, and then that person's allocated. You know, that, not sure if that answers your question, but
yeah, of course, Matt. Anything resonate for you there?
Yeah, probably should have had this conversation a few years ago, and said, Michael said that I need to be relieved of some of my duties to focus on projects. Sort of, Michael, as we're talking now, we just sort of go into a little bit deeper on like learning environments. And you know, as you're thinking about sort of the education sector, how do you think about the foundations of learning environment design? You know, what are some of the really sort of key pillars, if you like, for successful learning environmental design?
There are a lot of trends in education design, and it's hard to understand whether it's Emperor's New Clothes or it's actually a great thing. I think there are a lot of horses for courses, and it's a matter of what does the school believe in, and how do they want to teach is the question that we're asking. We do get asked at interviews, you know, what's the latest thing in, you know, flexible teaching spaces and blah, blah, blah. There's lots of different words. And a lot of it's not new. You know, we've done all this 30, 40 years ago, and, you know, sometimes it succeeds, sometimes it doesn't, of teaching spaces. I mean, we've got a school, you know, probably one of the leading academic schools in Brisbane, and we did some work with them, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago on super flexible team teaching, fancy classrooms. But they invested a lot of time and effort in there, and they've just come full circle. So we're actually, the work we're doing with them is traditional sage on a stage, 25 tables all facing the front. No technology, just a teacher and a piece of chalk and a blackboard. It, you know, not quite that basic, but it's not too dissimilar to that. Yes, there's an electronic screen and a few other things, but you know, because they've just worked out their school philosophy is a certain style of learning, and how the method that they, you know, get the best out of their students is that way. In their classrooms, there's other processes in libraries and other spaces that work differently. But so for us, it's not, hey, we're the expert and we're foisting this planning model on you. It's how do you want to teach, and how does your community want to learn? And then we work with you to figure out what that means. Because I don't think there is a right way, or you know, that is applicable to everybody. Different schools have different philosophies, different communities, different learning groups, you know. We're not the experts in that. That you know, our school leaders are, you know, that's what they do for a living. We're experts at trying to tease out of their brains how they want to do that and then what physical facilities they need to achieve that. So I get very nervous when people are asking me about, you know, what's the latest trend, you know, because I don't know. I don't know if they're right. I go to a lot of conferences and hear about them and I go, yeah, that's interesting. But it really does require the school to be on board with that. You know, we're doing some new age teaching facilities for a couple of schools, but that's their thing and that's how they want to teach and it's how their community want to learn. And it's, you know, it's a great thing when it's done properly.
I guess to ask that question in reverse then, you know, over the last two decades, you know, like trends come and go in education often, and educators would be able to list off 8 to 10 trends over the last 20 years. Are you able to kind of give, you know, a couple of the trends that you've seen over the past kind of, you know, maybe decade or two when it comes to, you know, building design for education?
I think you do see these various planning models and classrooms and teaching models. For us, that is just a type of delivery. And if it's relevant to the way you want to teach, then we'll jump on board with that. And as I said before, we've got two very different client groups where we've got current projects and they are at opposite ends of the spectrum. You know, we're doing, you know, 1800s classroom, well, not the sizes, but for 25 kids, not 60 or 70, for an elite Brisbane school and a similar, you know, similar sort of, no, it is a different demographic, but it is still one of the sort of better, well, considered private schools up the North Coast. It's the complete opposite. It is, you know, there's no walls, there's flexible furniture, you know, kids come and go, the interactive learning. So, I don't like trends. I think that, you know, it's like fashion. You know, keep those bell bottom trousers. One day, you know, somebody will think that they're fair flares or whatever. We try to steer away from that because, you know, the structures that we're building are there for a long time and they're huge investments by the school. So, you know, I can understand if say a new leadership team in a school is trying to maneuver the school a different way, then you've got to have some flexibility in these structures to be able to change and to allow different methodologies over time because things do change. But as we've seen in this, the first example I gave you, you know, that school's come sort of full circle, and we're building traditional classrooms again. And I think part of our delivery for a school is sort of understanding that trends do come and go. So even though we are doing a specific thing, you've sort of got to not have it too specific so that, you know, there is an opportunity for new ways, new thinking processes or just different styles.
Yeah, so Ed, I think it's that notion too that schools mature and grow and change as well. One of the things I'm a bit interested in is this notion that, you know, we see lots of new builds from time to time, and I've been in lots of schools that have done new builds and have had great aspirations for what teaching and learning might look like. But when the building gets opened, they throw teachers in there. They just go about doing the things that they've always done, and they actually haven't made that leap in terms of philosophy and actually using the building the way it was designed. Have you got any examples like that where, you know, you've done everything you can to come up with the right design brief, the right design, the right building, and then the stakeholders actually just haven't embraced it?
I think that if that happens, Matt, that's you know, there's obviously been a failure somewhere along the way where, you know, there isn't the right buy-in across the whole of the education client group or community. Because if you are developing a project with and you're trying to change a learning strategy or teaching methodology in the school, and the school community are on board, you know, that's part of the briefing process. It's part of the conversations with the leadership group all the way through to, you know, detailed space planning with technical staff and what they need to facilitate that teaching and learning process. like if it's there, it's authentic and it sort of happens all the way through. If it's, I think the example where, you know, you're disappointed that it doesn't happen at the end is probably more the fault at the start of the process where someone's gone, you know, I want that shiny thing. I don't really understand it, but everyone else is doing it and let's buy one of them. But it's, there's no ownership of it. There's no, and it just doesn't carry through. It is, and that's why I was saying these processes are huge investments. You can't just grab that shiny thing and just have one because it's not going to work. It's the same when you're buying, you know, anything, toys for toddlers, all the way through to brand new school buildings. You know, that's where they fall down. If there's no ownership of from the school, then it's not going to work.
Is there any, is there examples in your reflection of the design work you've done where, you know, that you go back later on or you're reflecting on the design after it's built, and I'm assuming that sometimes you look at things and go, that's exactly how I hoped it would work, but there's other times where maybe you kind of go, well, we could have got X, Y, and Z. You know, slightly, we could have done that slightly differently. And I'm just wondering on that reflection process for architects, because I think at a school end, like the building gets delivered, the design team pops some, champagne corks, and then everyone kind of, goes their separate way for a couple of years until the next building kind of comes along. But probably we don't get that, I think, from a client point of view, that reflection on does the architect, think that what we've got is as good as it could be. Do you get a sense of what I'm asking?
Yeah, and I mean, there's a whole profession in that, post-occupancy evaluation. You know, it's one of the things that we learn. But it is hugely important. And the lessons, from one client's experiences often can translate. Sometimes they don't if there's different philosophy. We like to develop a relationship with a school, and most of our successful projects they're typically not one-offs. We virtually insist that we start with a master planning process, but as part of that journey you're getting into the school, so the first project that you do, the relationship continues, and so by default you're doing that post-occupancy evaluation. You're actually seeing firsthand what happens and how it works, and what learnings can be sort of brought into the next project. You know, hopefully those are in the details and not in the philosophy and the big picture, because if you haven't got that right, then the relationship wasn't there in the first place. I think, there's very few school projects where we've done just a one-off project and we've not done any work ever again. We tend to get into the philosophy of the school. And so, sometimes it's not right. Sometimes we're not on the right wavelength. You know, we're not, we don't profess to be the architects for every school, but there are, there are schools and relationships and all relationships with principals or leaders that do endure. And as part of that opportunity, you do get to see how things are being used and what you might change and do differently. There are so many moving parts and decisions that are made in a project. Sometimes you don't have the ability to do that thing, but at least you're aware of it and you can explain, this thing is really letting this project down, whether it's an acoustic treatment or a movement pattern, and you reflect, how did that decision get made? Was it as simple as budget or changing student numbers that weren't predicted? Those sorts of things. Yeah, that's part of being in the industry.
If you love what we do here at EdLeaders, then please support us by supporting our sponsors. And today's episode sponsor is Veracross. Is your school ready for the modern age? Well, we've got good news for you. Veracross, the leading CIS provider for private and independent schools, is now available in Australia. Trusted by hundreds of schools in more than 30 countries around the world, Veracross is the only 100% cloud-based single record database built exclusively for private and independent schools. It's one system for your entire school. Integrations with popular edtech solutions like Schoolbox, Pixivity, and Digistorm enable seamless workflows and easy-to-access information. Plus, their in-country data center improves network speed and privacy, so you can rest easy knowing your school's data is secure and protected with Veracross. Make 2023 the year your school moves to the cloud. To learn more about Veracross, visit veracross.com/edleaders. That's veracross.com/edleaders. And it would mean the world to us if you or your school's director of IT check them out. Now back to today's show.
Michael, you sort of touched on that notion of, starting with a master plan. And I think it's trying to unpack the philosophy of a whole school. Just wondering if you could sort of describe how, you know, a new build within a master plan communicates to the community what's of value here. So wanting to go sort of in that next layer of how a building speaks to, you know, creates a narrative for the community of what's important.
Yeah, it should and can speak to the master plan. So there's master plans and there's master plans, Matt. So it is the master plan needs to be more than just a bubble diagram of where you're going to plonk boxes on a site. The master plan is that introduction to the philosophy of the school and who and where and why. A really easy example to sort of get across is a school, a Catholic school in the northern suburbs of Brisbane that we've done work with. They don't have a huge building program. We did a bunch of work for them maybe a dozen years ago, and they're now starting to talk about doing the next thing. But it's a Franciscan-based school, and they have a belief system, they have a philosophy, and it is based around those fundamentals of their founding setup. And for that school, we spent a lot of time with them trying to understand what that meant to them, and the basic tenets of back to nature and all those things were there, and they talk about it, but none of the physical infrastructure reflected that. So the first move in that school master plan was just acknowledging it. So the first thing we actually built for them was a garden, and you enter the school through a working food garden. You know, there's chook tractors and all that sort of stuff. But for a private school, you know, you're walking through the smells of the, you know, chickens and whatnot. But it was important to them, and it really set the scene for everything else that's sort of followed, that it's not about being flashy and having the fancy big building and all the rest of it. It's getting back to those basic natural things of what Francis, St. Francis believed in and the philosophies of the school. So that's an easy way of sort of showing it. You know, it became a garden-based thing. So the science program evolved around the upper levels of that garden, and it was the scientific process. And then, you know, home ec opened onto the garden, and they used the produce in there. You know, so you can take that philosophy all the way through, or you can just sort of ignore it and have it on a piece of paper and keep it different. So that one's an easy example, and it's a great school to walk through because it's just so obvious. But you know, it had existed for 50 years before we started doing that, and no one had thought of it. Yeah, showing that ethos, that's the thing.
I have a follow-up question there around, you know, for the audience, for our audience out there who, you know, may potentially one day be principals, that notion of, you know, like a master plan like you've described, or they come into any school and there's an existing master plan. What's your advice to a new principal who hasn't developed that master plan themselves and maybe learning kind of like the ethos and the culture of the school to able to unpack and understand the master plan before they go off on a different tangent and go, I'm creating a whole new master plan?
Yeah, okay. So there is a period of reflection because you've tied two things in there with a new principal coming through. So, you know, there's a learning process for them. I think you would want to understand if that master plan is appropriate to the school community and the school's philosophy, then you would want to be going gently with with that. But if the master plan is actually not really about the school itself, then yes, that is something that you would want to unpick and understand, because that becomes the guiding document for the building side of it. And so if that's not there, it does become a very difficult process. You know, you're investing millions and millions of dollars and, you know, you put the box in the wrong place. It's a hard thing. You do see it often, you know, a new principal comes into a school and wants to stamp their mark, and the easiest thing to do is to offer a new master plan, a new building. If it's well thought out and part of the school, not just the individual, then it can be a great thing. But it can also be a very disruptive thing as well. You know, there's a particular school I can think of. You know, they've had three or four principals over the last dozen years, and each one of them has just come in with this new vision and new master plan, and nothing's been done and nothing's really been built. And it's just been this churn that's been very frustrating for that particular school community. Yeah, tread carefully, but again, if it's not there, then there's a fantastic opportunity to reset the school. And if that's what your new principalship is about, then yes, it is a thing. You know, architects often don't survive the change and transition in leadership, and there's a number of reasons for that. You know, it sort of goes with the territory. But you know, on a number of our schools, I we have survived that transition, and that's probably due to the authenticity of that master plan and that the new leadership team buys into that. You know, if the school's changing, that's different. But if the school is just, you know, on a journey and it's the same journey, just, you know, more detail or larger or whatever it is, then if that master plan's appropriate for it, then run with it.
Michael, I just want to keep on this sort of notion of the master plan and how it speaks to a culture of a place. You know, you talked about how, you know, the garden was, you know, was a tenet of this concept of nature for this school. When you're thinking about the campus as a whole, what are some of the, I guess, the markers that you look for to tie, I guess, building or the built infrastructure together to make a very sort of clear narrative of you know, values, culture, et cetera?
Tricky question, Matt, because every school is different. We do work for a number of schools that are you know, sandstone or established schools with heritage listed foundation buildings and all the rest of it, and that's a very different philosophy and you know, material choice to a school that might be in the inner city that has one or two heritage listed buildings but is, you know, surrounded by concrete and glass and all the rest of it. It really depends on the project. That there are so many different ways to approach the school and its philosophy. It is about the school itself and what do they believe in. Are they wanting to establish or reinforce that traditional methodology or look, or maybe it's just respecting what's come in the past. You know, there are different ways to think about heritage. I mean, you know, one of the oldest buildings, you know, educational buildings in a school, you know, the rest of the campus that we've done for them, their buildings are so modern it's not funny, but they still respect that tradition. So there's just different ways to do it. It's horses for courses. We don't have a style. We don't have a something that we're forcing upon the client. We're trying to discover that thing for that particular client. Hedging my bets, man.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. Just sitting on the fence there. Like, I just find it interesting.
It's not about me, it's about you.
No, that's right. Yeah, yeah, got it.
It's not me, it's you.
You know, just thinking about that kind of traditional builds and heritage listed things. And, you know, I've seen schools that have been able to pick up the threads of just the colors and materials to kind of just, you know, make some points along the way in new builds. But I've also equally seen just really deep contrast. And I think that notion of respecting what's come before in terms of the aesthetic, I think that's really, really interesting. And that's a very big spectrum, you know, from, you know, building what's already there, you know, in that style versus something that's really modern and contrasting.
Yeah. And we, you know, it's the 2020s and building technology and costs and all the rest of it have moved on. So there are ways to build modern and respect older buildings. it is a tricky tightrope. But whether it is, as you say, pulling a thread out of that history of the school, whether it's a colour or a pattern or a form, and developing that as a motif or a material or a colour choice in a new building, you know, that's one way of tying it together. Other schools just want it to be, no, we've got that. That's our heritage. It's been here for 100 years. And this building, it's modern, shiny glass, completely different. This is, you know, there's no right or wrong way. That works for that school, whereas another school that just might be the antithesis of what they believe in. So
you talked there about the fact that we're in the 2020s. One of the things, if leaders out there who have been involved in some building conversations over the last few years would know, is that there's been some unprecedented kind of cost increases, in the building game. I'm wondering if you can talk to us about what you've observed in the last kind of probably 2 years when it comes to that, and how that compares, to the last decade or two.
It has been it has been a hard thing for our market, as in the education market, and a lot of that is to do with the building component of what we do with schools. That's not their bread and butter, right? They're very good at, you know, the learning side of it and the philosophy and all the rest of it. And a lot of our schools, you know, most of our work is independent schools, and, you know, they're run by boards and they're volunteers and they're members of the community who also may not be professional building industry people. And when sudden change happens, so, you know, cost escalation is tied in with COVID and government grants and things that sort of boosted parts of the industry and just exacerbated the issue. So, you know, we had amazing cost increase a couple of years ago. But the difference between working with a secondary school client that is not necessarily a professional building client versus a tertiary education institution, they sort of understand and they have professional building people within those organizations. So the big difference the big thing we noticed was that a lot of schools then just went into shutdown and panic mode. And, you know, oh, wow, you know, we can't deal with this. Let's just stop everything and reassess, and, you know, maybe costs will go down next year and all that, all those sorts of things. And I think that was probably the hardest thing to convince people that is exactly the wrong decision to make in a rising market. And unfortunately, we've got a couple of schools that have suffered through that. You know, they've put projects on hold, projects that were needed and necessary, and so now they're doing them 2 years later. We've had that little jump. Well, it was a massive jump. But costs in the building industry they're not going to go down. I mean, I can't guarantee they're not going to go down, but they tend to jump and plateau and then jump again depending on what happens. So that was a huge, huge challenge for the education market. And I'm sure it's similar in Perth, you know, as it is here, where government programs and other things are influencing the costs of construction. And it's all about supply and demand. And so, you know, we've got these major infrastructure projects happening, and we've got sort of a large amount of money, you know, being bottled up for years and years, and all of a sudden released onto new hospitals. And for us, we've got the Olympics coming up. So, you know, construction costs are just out of control. So it's all about how to deal with that and how to manage it as best you can. And it is hard. But if that project needs to be built, then it's about how do you set up systems in place to minimize the damage rather than make it worse. So for us, it was about educating clients that, you know what, costs are going up really fast. So one of the key things that a client can do to assist is actually to figure out how to work fast and make fast decisions, as opposed to slowing things down. That was the biggest thing in that portion of the market. I mean, you know, there's lots of little things that you can go through on how to do that, but it's a matter of being nimble and moving quickly rather than stopping and putting your head in the sand. But it's an easy thing to say, and it's a very hard thing to do.
And it's interesting, that notion of delaying a decision or delaying a build, and people might think that they're doing it for strategic reasons, but I think the notion that you're sort of speaking to is that it comes at a cost, by delaying a decision, you're actually adding strategic risk in some ways, you know, to the future of a build.
You are. And if you're delaying it for the right reason, Matt, if maybe if leadership has thought, you know what, we haven't actually quite got our philosophy right, or, you know, they're great reasons for delaying a project. But in a moving, you know, so if we talk about costs, that delay for the sake of delay is just adding cost. So it just means you've either got to find more money, or you've got to drop something out, or something else suffers. Yeah, it is tricky. I mean, you don't want to push a project too fast. You want to make sure that all those sound decisions are made. But the thing that a school environment can do is actually just set it up so that decisions can be made thoroughly and quickly, and, you know, free up that that person, Matt, that so that they can work on it full time, as opposed to you know, so that decisions can be made, but also so that the whole school community is on board, so that there is not, you know, unnecessary roadblocks. You know, like, so we usually encourage people to just have a really small user group. You know, it might be a deputy principal and a business manager, and that's it, or whatever it is, so that those decisions can be nimble and quick. But those people have got to, you know, bring the rest of the community on board, so that say you're at a school board meeting and you're presenting that project, there's not the question or the decision that then goes, you know what, I want some more research done on this particular topic, bring it back to the next meeting, you know, and that's in 2 months' time. So, yeah, there's lots of things in the school market that do slow projects down that you can really change if you need to. And I think in a booming market, that's where a school can actually get a lot of good value, is just looking at their own processes and how to speed those up.
Just to, I guess, zero in on an example, if you could, you know, I guess, like, if a building was going to cost, let's say, 15 million kind of 3 years ago, and a school's made that decision to delay based on, you know, a number of reasons, what does that look like today? You know, what has been the actual change in terms of dollars and, you know, now with, I guess, rising interest rates that are kind of coming in? What are you seeing as the real shift in what it's truly costing, either something not to have been built or the true cost of delaying, you know, are these builds?
Yeah, I mean, the scary example is picking that time frame, you know, probably 12 to 18 months ago, Luke, when across the board, I think, we get a lot of data from quantity surveyors and others in the building industry, and, you know, cost increases between 35% and 45% were the reality. So that's, you know, just over a third to almost half your budget. So that $15 million project has just turned into, you know, a low 20s. And it's a phenomenal change. And that's a, you know, potentially you've got to take, you know, a third of your, you know, reduce the size of your project if the budget has to stay the same, or to cut out a lot of things. So, yeah, huge impacts. And we did see costs settle down a little bit. You know, the traditional sort of average is between 4% to 6% an annum, and that, it sounds a lot, you know, it's probably not too dissimilar to your interest rates and all the rest of it, but it's sort of manageable, and people understand that, and if it's consistent, you know, your forecast escalation and your cost plans and all those sorts of things. But when you have these major jumps, that's hard. And it did flatline. It sort of flatlined a little bit. And then, you know, as the industry gets more time to absorb this, you sort of start to understand, oh, that cost increases in, I don't know, brick or steel or whatever. So maybe we should steer over this way where things are a little bit more economical. It takes time to work some of that stuff out. But broadly, costs aren't going to go down. They tend to flatline for a little bit and then they'll sort of peak up. But it's all about supply and demand. And for, this is what I was saying before, with the government interventions and infrastructure work, and just the lack of materials and skilled labour, there's so much pressure on costs that it's just something we now have to be super aware of and manage very, very carefully.
Mike, I'm just interested, you sort of were just talking about the labour market, and it's probably something the schools don't even think about, you know, as they embark on building projects. We know on our side of the country, builders aren't even putting in for tenders for builds sort of from 5 mil to 20 mil. They just, they're just not. You know, and so, and we've obviously had a few big players go under as well. What's the market look like in your neck of the woods in terms of builders, you know, putting in for tender or not even bothering?
I think it's probably very similar, Matt. There have been just because costs are going up, it doesn't mean building firms are making a lot of money. They're caught. And you're right, you know, we've had quite a few prominent, not just construction firms, but also subcontractors and the rest, you know, not be able to manage their way through that, and they have gone under. I mean, our market, the building industry goes through booms and busts all the time. You know, every 6-10 years we go through a cycle. So it's a matter of knowing where you are in that cycle and then doing what you need to do to get that construction project to happen. So, yeah, people aren't interested in tendering is a broad, you know, it's a fairly broad statement. It's people are interested, you know, building firms still need to get work, but they're interested in tendering the projects that minimise the risk for them. So it's what sort of project or what type of procurement methodology. So if you're able to be a little bit more nimble with how you want to present your project to the market to make it more attractive than the other bloke's project, you know, you can get builders. Builders need an ongoing supply of work. They just are able to be or need to be. I mean, well-managed building firms need to be picky and choosy about how they price projects. So if your contract terms and the procurement methodology doesn't allow the builder to minimise their risk, then, you know, I'll go and work on a, you know, go and work for someone else that is happy to share the risk. Because if you try to put all that risk on the poor builder, you know, why would they come and do your project? So sometimes you've got to look at innovative ways to attract, you know, whether it's attracting the right staff or the right builder to your team. You know, you might not be able to pay top dollar, but you might be able to offer a better lifestyle or a better remuneration package to that staff. Sorry, not dollar package to that staff member, but more PD or, you know, whatever the other thing is. It's exactly the same in the building industry, just with, you know, a few more zeros on it. So it's tricky and it's hard to get pricing, but if you're flexible with how you do that, then there are ways because, you know, the construction industry still needs to work. You've just got to make your project more attractive.
You talked a little bit a question or two ago about the materials and choice of materials that you can use. You talked there a little bit about procurement processes. I guess I'm interested in maybe a societal shift towards sustainability and the notion of sustainability when it comes to either new buildings or refurbishing existing buildings. And I'm just curious as to whether you can elaborate on what you've kind of seen, you know, schools' approaches to sustainability when it comes to new buildings or new projects, should I say?
Yeah, it is very varied, Luke. There is a perception that adding sustainability layers just adds a lot of cost. It doesn't have to be that way. You know, there are a number of rating systems and things that, while they're very useful from a marketing point of view and an education point of view, you know, they can add costs and layers. But, you know, we've had clients that go, you know what, we're not interested in doing that particular system, but we want to adopt a lot of their philosophies, without going overboard. So, you know, it depends on how far you want to go. There's sort of the big picture things that are just sensible decisions, you know, right the way through to, you know, the amazing certification systems and the marketing spiel that and process that you can have with that. You know, that Franciscan school that we were talking about, you know, we built a working horse GLA classroom block. I think it's for 16 just standard GLAs. Yes, there's sliding doors between them. No air conditioning in Brisbane. It's great. It's a great building and environment to work in because that was just the philosophy at the start. So, you know, it's orientated to the west, you know, which is another crazy move. But, you know, it's a Catholic school. They're on a hill, of course. We're able to catch a bit of a breeze and it functions really well because, you know, they just decided we're not going to air condition it. That's it. And how do you make it work, Mr. Architect? Go and do it. And it works. You know, we save the money in mechanical systems and all the rest of it, but we spent it in, you know, sunshading and capturing breezes and cross-flow ventilation, and then because we're opening doors, then you've got acoustic issues with, you know, surrounding neighbours and all the rest of it. So it wasn't a cost-saving decision per se. It was a philosophy. Whereas there would be plenty of schools that would be horrified to say that they have a whole bunch of rooms that aren't air-conditioned on their, you know, website, you know. That would just be like our government is just going on and on about, you know, cooling schools and spending money. We're air-conditioning every single classroom by whatever date. I mean, they do. They have to because they're so poorly designed that they're just hot boxes. So, yeah, it is an attitude, Luke, and you can do things without spending a lot of money necessarily. It's probably more about redirecting the money and where you do spend it. But the new build versus, you know, recycle buildings is also an interesting conversation. You know, the new build is the big shiny thing and looks great on a website and all that sort of stuff. Whereas if we can actually repurpose an existing building, that's so much better in terms of resources and all of those things. So, you know, if it is about building a brand new building that looks sustainable versus an actual philosophy, then yeah, it's an interesting conversation. We do work for a major tertiary institution, and they do want the hero green building to be built, and they're actively trying to get that to happen. But we've, you know, they've got a whole bunch of empty old buildings that are doing nothing, you know. So some of those projects, not just by us but by other architects, have been quietly refurbished and converted and reappropriated, and they're probably going to be so much further ahead than some fancy new super, you know, 10-star green star building in terms of the actual reality of sustainability. But it's sort of not as sexy in the media. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a philosophy thing.
Really interesting insights. Sort of, Michael, as we sort of head towards the end of our time together, I wonder if you've got any last words of advice for leaders looking to embark on a new building project.
Well, once you've got your team, Matt, I think you've got to be able to trust them. You need to empower them to do what they're good at. So giving them the tools to do their jobs. And then it's about being, you know, authentic and open and just communicating what you're really trying to achieve in your project, not necessarily what you think other people want you to achieve. So yeah, probably that you know, that access to leadership, culture, communication, all those things are the keys, I think, to getting fantastic results in building projects, like anything, you know. Yeah.
Great.
Well, with that, it brings us to our favourite segment. Well, at least my favourite segment anyway. Matt always shakes his head and disagrees with me, but that's okay. It's called 6 in 60 Seconds, Michael.
Oh, no.
So one word or idea, and just to put it out there, no one follows the rules when it comes to one word or idea. So, you know, you do what you like. One architectural idea that's been overrated or underrated in the past decade.
I'll go with the flexible learning thing. It's very, very overrated at the moment.
Ooh, controversial. I didn't know whether you were going to say underrated or overrated.
Maybe I shouldn't have said that, Ben.
Could have left it up to the audience to decide. The most important environmental element of any campus.
Your culture.
Mm.
The most interesting campus visit you've ever done.
Ooh, I'll pass on that one.
Oh, not gonna have a favorite child. Okay. See, breaking the rules. All right. If you could change one rule or one thing about learning environment design, what would it be?
Learning environment. The layers of management between the design team and the, you know, the people that drive the culture in the school.
One book worth reading.
Oh my goodness. So I'm currently reading a traditional building, and it's very boring for you guys. I'm studying up on traditional building techniques in old Queenslanders at the moment.
All right. I haven't heard of that as a recommended book.
That's new.
That's worth reading, but we'll go with it. We'll have to look that one up and put it on the show notes. And one person we should interview on the podcast.
Ooh, probably the first principal that we work with. She's semi-retired now, Dr. Amanda Bell. Don't know whether you'd be able to track her down. She's in.
I'm sure I've seen her on LinkedIn, so we'll have to look her up.
Yeah, no, she's been a. She's educated us a lot in schools and challenged us, and she was our first secondary school client. Yeah.
Always good to look after your first clients with a recommendation.
We're still working with her. I mean, she's semi-retired, but she's assisting, schools and, sitting on various boards and things. So she challenges us.
That's great.
And I think that goes to one of your earlier points about relationships, doesn't it? Well, that brings an end to our show for today. I hope you've enjoyed our little chat, all things building and architecture with Michael. Matt, I know you've got them. Hit us. Closing comments.
Yeah, well, I just have a dream of being an architect, so that'd be my ideal job. So today's been fantastic. Look, I love that idea that, architect's job is to really understand how a school wants to teach. And it's that notion that, we've got the problem, but architect's role is to design a solution. I love that notion, and perhaps some people that I work for could listen around investment in human resources. To run a project's a big job, and it needs manpower. I love that notion too, or the importance of a master plan that speaks to the culture and values and ethos of a school. And just a reminder to boards, particularly if they're delaying decisions, what cost does that come at? I think that's really, really important. So there's just a few highlights for me today. What about you, Luke?
Look, I couldn't go past the importance of the master plan either, and kind of going deeper on understanding kind of like the real philosophy and kind of the underpinning kind of history and culture of a school, and how important that document can be in, I guess, empowering current leaders but future leaders around, the fabric of what the community kind of expects, but the built kind of environment that can kind of live and breathe, the good design can live and breathe those underpinning philosophies. So for me, I kind of thought that really kind of was an important kind of aspect. I kind of also just that notion of, the ongoing relationships with people, and, particularly with teams like architects, that, the importance of having trust and empowering, teams, both internal and external, to get the job done, over many years is super important in schools, because chopping and changing and, this architect and then that architect and this builder and then that builder, and they don't understand, your people and trying to understand those teams and the importance of who's who in the zoo can be really problematic. So that's for me. So Michael, look, thank you so much for giving up your early hours on a Friday morning to spend an hour with us and our audience of aspiring and current leaders across the country. For the audience out there, if they want to connect with you or learn more about, the work you're doing, or connect with you about future building works, where's the best place that they can find you on the internet?
Yeah, I mean, it's all the normal social media channels, but happy for someone just to get on the phone and have a chat. So, details are on our website. We're open to having conversations and chatting to people to assist them with their projects. But yeah, there is a fair bit of information and background on the various projects and philosophies on our website. So that's probably the easiest thing, Luke. And, those two summaries are fantastic. I'm glad you got those things out of it, because I think you've nailed it. Yeah.
And for the uninitiated out there, if you could just spell out the website, m3architecture.com, is that correct?
That's correct. Yep.
Excellent. And that's the number three, not written three, just so the audience knows where to find you. Remember, if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show, and don't forget to share the love and tell a few of your colleagues, or maybe the person responsible for your next PD day, that your staff should be listening to an episode of Ed Leaders, or that your leadership team, if they're thinking of building, should be listening to this particular episode. As I mentioned at the top of the show, if you're not signed up to the Ed Leaders newsletter, you are missing out. We publish every couple of weeks, and it's jam-packed with nuggets to level up your school leadership game. Check out edleaders.com.au for more details. Thanks again to the sponsors of today's show, and we would be grateful, really grateful, if you could spend a few minutes going to their website and checking out their wares as they support us to make professional learning like this free for you. You can connect with Ed Leaders and both of us on LinkedIn, where we'll keep you up to date with what we're up to and all the latest. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Go well.